of basic goods and the falsification of election results. Their protests took them to the offices of most obvious representatives of the regime, not the party, but the Stasi. They cried, "Democracy, now or never! Stasi, out! And SED, you're hurting me!" In August, the Hungarians cut the barbed wire at their border with Austria, creating the first hole in the Eastern Bloc. Thousands of East Germans flocked there and ran, crying with relief and anger, across the border. Thousands more travelled to the West German embassies in Prague and Warsaw and set up camp, creating a diplomatic nightmare in German-German relations. Finally, the regime agreed to let them out, on condition that the trains taking them to West Germany travel through the GDR. Honecker hoped to humiliate the expellees by confiscating their identity papers, and he wanted them to fear, as they did, that he would stop the trains and arrest the passengers. Honecker's plans backfired. The people on the trains ripped up their identity papers with tears of joy. Thousands flocked to the stations to see if they could climb aboard and to cheer on their compatriots. In early October, Leipzig was at a flashpoint. Petrol station attendants were refusing to refill police vehicles. The children of servicemen were being barred from creches. Those who worked in the centre of town near the Nikolaikirche were sent home early. Hospitals called for more blood. People made their wills and said things they wanted their children to remember before going out to demonstrations. There were rumours of tanks and helicopters and water cannon coming, but then so were the postcards from friends who had already reached the West. The people went onto the streets. Honecker ordered that the counter-revolutionaries in Leipzig were to be nipped in the bud. "Nothing," he said, "can hinder the progress of socialism." On the 8th of October, Milke began to activate the plans for Day X, sending out orders to the local Stasi branches to open their envelopes. But things were already too far gone. Instead of incarcerating the people, the Stasi, hiding in their buildings, locked themselves up. In the regional offices, they had 60,000 pistols, more than 30,000 machine guns, hand grenades, sharpshooters' rifles, anti-tank guns, and tear gas. Fears of lynching ran high. Leipzig police were shown photographs of a Chinese policeman immolated by the mob at Tiananmen Square and told, "It's you or it's them." But they were also ordered not to shoot or use violence unless it was used against them. On the 7th of October 1989, the GDR celebrated its 40 years of existence with lavish parades in Berlin. There was a sea of red flags, a torchlight procession, and tanks. The old men on the podium wore light grey suits studded with medals. Mikhail Gorbachev stood next to Honecker, but he looked uncomfortable among the much older Germans. He had come to tell them it was over, to convince the leadership to adopt his reformist policies. He had spoken openly about the dangers of not responding to reality. He pointedly told the Politburo that life punishes those who come too late. Honecker and Milke ignored him, just as they ignored the crowds when they chanted, "Gorby, help us! Gorby, help us!" In Leipzig, the extraordinary courage of the people didn't waver, and it didn't break out into anything else. On the 9th of October, 70,000 protesters went out in the dark in big coats and carrying candles. They stood outside the Runde Ecke with their demands, "Reveal the Stasi informers! We are not rowdies! We are the people!" And the constant, constant call of "No violence!" From that night on, the demonstrations grew. Footage of them was smuggled to the West, and Leipzig came to be known as the City of Heroes. There were now protests outside Stasi offices all over the country, and even in the smallest towns, the Stasi men in them continued their meticulous work, faithfully sending back to Berlin reports of the demands of the crowds outside. "Stasi to the factories," heard at Zeulenroda. "We earn your money," from Schmalkalden, and the prescient, "Your days are numbered," Bad Salzungen. In Leipzig, the demonstrators had started to shout, Occupy the Stasi building now, and we're staying here. The party belatedly tried to change its image. On the 17th of October, Honecker was ousted by his deputy, Egon Krenz, who, although younger, was just as disliked. Proceedings were started against Honecker on the 8th of November for abuse of office and corruption. On the 9th of November, thinking to deal with the crisis, the Politburo met and decided to relax travel restrictions. People would be allowed to travel freely and be prohibited from leaving the country only in special exceptional circumstances. The session went into the night. At this stage, the regime had taken to holding a regular press conference with the international media. That evening, Politburo member Gunter Schabowski needed to get to it. He hadn't been at the session, but was hastily given a note of its decision to read out at the press conference. When he finished, there was no visible reaction among the journalists in the room. All pens were poised. The boom mics floated in the air. Then a question came from the floor. When will this new provision come into force? Schabowski has baggy eyes and a face like a bloodhound. Embarrassed, he looked at the paper. He turned it over but found no answer.
It will come into force, to my knowledge, immediately, he said.
The decision was to have become operable the next day, after the border guards had been instructed on its implementation. But as soon as Schabowski had spoken, it was too late. Within hours of his blunder, 10,000 people were at the Bornholmer Bridge checkpoint on foot and in their Trabant cars, thronging to the wall. The light from the death strip showed up breath, exhaust. There was a symphony of horns. The guard stood at trigger point, but no orders came. Eventually, the supervisor decided to let the people through on one condition. The guards were to place the exit stamp to the left of the passport photographs of the most importunate, those at the front of the queue, so that they could later be identified and refused re-entry. The people didn't know, and they didn't care. They streamed through into West Berlin. When the first few came back with cans of Western beer to show where they'd been, the guards tried to stop them coming home, but it was too late. It was all over, and the people from East and West were climbing, crying, and dancing on the wall. Chapter 7. The Smell of Old Men. Here, at the Normannenstrasse headquarters, there was panic. Stasi officers were instructed to destroy files, starting with the most incriminating, those naming Westerners who spied for them, and those that concerned deaths. They shredded the files until the shredders collapsed. Among other shortages in the East, there was a shredder shortage, so they had to send agents out undercover to West Berlin to buy more. In Building 8 alone, members of the citizens' movement found over 100 burnt-out shredders. When the Stasi couldn't get any more machines, they started destroying the files by hand, ripping up documents and putting them into sacks. But this was done in such an orderly fashion, whole drawers of documents put into the same bag, that now, in Nuremberg, it is possible for the puzzle women to piece them back together. On the 13th of November, Mielke, aged 81, became desperate about the waning of his world. He made his first and only address to the Parliament. It was broadcast live.
Dear comrades, he opened,
and the booing began.
Cries of, We are not your comrades,
came from the newly independent minor parties. Then, as if he simply could not understand why he might be disliked, Mielke stammered into the microphone.
I love, he said, but I love all people. I put myself out for you.
When they think of Mielke, East Germans like to think of this. Perhaps there is something healing about ridicule. It is a relief, anyway, from terror and anger. On the 3rd of December, along with Mielke, Krenz was expelled from the party. Hans Modrow, a politician from Dresden, became leader. Modrow decided to change the name of the Ministry for State Security to the Office of National Security, Amt für Nationale Sicherheit, a cosmetic reform resulting in the deeply unfortunate acronym NAZI. Nobody was fooled. The group of West Germans touring the building has become tighter. The quiet jokes among the men have stopped, the looks between the wives. The guide asks whether they would like to see upstairs, but they shuffle and shake their heads and say they probably don't have time today. "Well then," she says, "we come now to the end of our story." With her bossy manner and her twitching nose, she is not going to let these Westerners go until she has told them how the people took this building. She says that in January 1990, when the Berliners saw the smoke coming out of the chimneys, they came here to protest. They brought bricks and rocks and built a symbolic wall around the building to get the Stasi to stop burning the files. She says it is extraordinary that, with all those stones, not one was thrown, and that, conversely, not one shot was fired from this building. "There were a lot of Stasi agents mingled in among the demonstrators," she sniffs, "and maybe that's why they didn't fire, fear of hitting a colleague." Eventually, after the Stasi had done all they could to remove or destroy the files, they opened the doors to the demonstrators. The denunciations against Milke began as soon as he lost power. And how could they not, his people being trained to the highest level in denunciation? The Berlin prosecutor's office received a note accusing Milke of using public funds to build his hunting estate. In January 1990, more counts were added to the indictment: suspicion of high treason, collaboration to subvert the Constitution, in that he, along with Erich Honecker, had instituted a nationwide system of post and telecommunication surveillance, and having, contrary to the law, denied people their freedom by locking them up in protective custody on the occasion of the GDR's 40th birthday. Milke was taken into remand. Through 1990 and 1991, he was in and out of custody in various Berlin prisons, including Hohenschönhausen, where he had sent most of his political detainees. Further counts were added, including the charge of murdering the police officers in 1931. Milke's trial began in 1992, but by the time it ended, the only accusations remaining concerned the Bulauplatz murders. For his part in those, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. The guide says to her flock, "It was ridiculous to get him for those old murders." Many people felt, though, at least it was something. He was released on health grounds in August 1995 and lives now not far from this building. Honecker fared worse. In early 1990, he was arrested on suspicion of corruption and high treason, but released from remand. In November of that year, he was accused of responsibility for killings at the wall, but fled to Moscow, from where he told the press he had no regrets and protested the arrest of former colleagues. In July 1992, he was extradited to Berlin to face trial, which was suspended the following January due to his terminal liver cancer. Honecker and his wife left for Chile, where he died in May 1994. As the party was losing its grip on the country, it started negotiating with the Runde Tisch, the consortium of East German citizens' rights activists and church groups. But even these were riddled with Stasi informers. Nevertheless, when the Runde Tisch passed a resolution at its first meeting on the 7th of December 1989, demanding that free elections be held and that the Stasi be dissolved under civilian control, most of the informers voted in favor. It seems they felt compelled, in order to maintain their cover, to vote for measures to destroy the regime that employed them. From 1989 to October 1990, debate raged hot in Germany as to what to do with the Stasi files. Should they be opened or burnt? Should they be locked away for 50 years and then opened, when the people in them would be dead or possibly forgiven? What were the dangers of knowing? or the dangers of ignoring the past and doing it all again with different coloured flags or neckerchiefs or helmets. In the end, some files were destroyed, some locked away, and some opened. The Runde Tisch decided that the Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung, the overseas arm of the Stasi, could disband itself. Too many files concerning too many foreign countries, not least the West German administration, which had been infiltrated by Stasi spies, were in this trove, and they were too dangerous. That left the files the Stasi kept on the people inside the GDR. Many East Germans, particularly those who'd been in power or informers, argued against making them available. The West German government argued this too. Did it fear embarrassment from what the files might reveal? Its own dealings which supported the regime? Or would there be indiscriminate bloodletting as people took revenge on informers? In August 1990, the first and only elected parliament of the GDR passed a law granting the right for people to see their own files. But the West German government, in its draft unification treaty for the two countries, prescribed that the files would all be delivered to the Federal Archives in Koblenz, West Germany, where, most likely, they would be locked away. Ordinary people in the GDR were horrified. They feared that all this information about them might continue to be used, or that they would never know how their lives had been manipulated by the firm. Protests began. On the 4th of September 1990, campaigners occupied the lobby here, and a week later they began a hunger strike. The protesters were successful, and provisions were included in the unification treaty regulating access to the files. On the 3rd of October 1990, the day of German reunification and the day that the GDR ceased to exist, the East German pastor, Joachim Gauck, took office as head of the newly formed Stasi File Authority. It was a close call, but Germany was the only Eastern Bloc country in the end that so bravely, so conscientiously, opened its files on its people, to its people. The group leaves, not even muttering among themselves anymore. I imagine they are in a hurry to get back to the international-style West Berlin hotel that reminds them of nothing, and I don't blame them. The guide comes over and asks me about my interest in the place. I explain that after the Runde Ecke in Leipzig, I wanted to see the Stasi headquarters. I say, though, that I'm looking to speak with people who confronted the regime, as much as those who represented it. "In that case, then," she says, "you need to meet Frau Paul." I follow her into her office, a small space lined with binders of files, and she gives me a phone number. I make my way up the stairs in the foyer. On the landing, glass cases display objects that hid tape recorders and cameras in order to document the enemy. There is more variety than I saw in Leipzig. A flower pot, a watering can, a petrol canister, and a car door, all with cameras of varying sizes hidden in them. There's a thermos with a microphone in its lid, a hiking jacket with a camera sewn into the lapel pocket, and an apparatus like a television antenna that could pick up conversations 50 meters away in other buildings, or while you were in your car stopped at lights. On the next landing I pass a black bust of Marx on a pedestal, godlike with flowing hair. One of the offices has been converted into a trophy room for Stasi trinkets. There are banners for each regiment, ribbons and medals for service and buttonhole pins as signs of seniority. There are miniature pointy-bearded Lenins in a range of sizes and a long row of clenched plaster fists sticking up for international socialism. There are trophies and vases and beer mugs with the GDR's hammer and compass insignia on them. A miniature boxed book set contains the life and deeds of Comrade Erich Honecker, and there's a locket-sized portrait of Mielke himself in, of all things, enamel. A carpet hangs on the wall, bearing the woolly triumvirate of Marx, Engels and Lenin in profile, next to a lurid hand-worked mat with the Stasi insignia in red, yellow and black acrylic. The rugs fascinate me. They demonstrate, I think, the value of labour over everything else here, mostly aesthetics and utility. A smaller room leads off from this one. At first I think it's going to be more revolutionary kitsch, but here there are just books and medals under glass. In fact, mostly there seem to be papers, but when I read them, I see why they deserve a room of their own. They are the 1985 plans of the Stasi, together with the army, for the invasion of West Berlin. The plans are methodical. They include the division of the new territory into Stasi branch offices, and figures for exactly how many Stasi men should be assigned to each. And there's a medal, cast in bronze, silver and gold, by order of Honecker, to be awarded after successful invasion, for courage in the face of the Western enemy. No one in the West had imagined the extent of the Stasi's ambitions. Milka's quarters are on the second story. There's no one around. My shoes make a plasticky noise on the lino till I reach his office where the floor is parquetry. It's a spacious room with the feel of well-kept impoverishment. It is the same sense you might get visiting someone who bought their furniture as a bride in the 1950s but never had the means to update it. In fact, everything seems to be in that particular 50s yellowy-green colour, nuclear mustard. The main feature of the room is a middling-sized veneer desk. As I approach, I pass a portrait of Lenin. His eyes follow me across the room. The only things on the desk are two telephones and a white plaster death mask of Lenin. Life-size, his head seems small compared with all the exaggerated versions of it in wall and paint and marble in the treasure chamber downstairs. It also looks very dead, a memento mori in this belief system, like a crucifix in another. Aside from his presence, though, this place could be the mayor's office in the down-at-heel council chambers of a small but proud rural town, whose people recall fondly the days when wool prices were high. The light is so bad now that outlines are blurring. I walk further, through Milka's private quarters, a daybed and chair, and personal bathroom, a plain tiled affair, to a larger anteroom, which now has cafeteria tables for tourists. It, too, is empty. There are a couple of old lounge chairs in one corner. A video plays on a television set. I move towards it, a source of light, and sit down to watch. The film shows amateur footage of demonstrators storming this building on the cold night of the 15th of January 1990. They walk through the offices, the supermarket, the hairdressers, opening locked rooms and staring at the sacks and sacks of paper. They didn't seem jubilant. They didn't even show much bravado. Their faces wore instead a quiet mixture of disgust and sadness. I have heard this particular feeling described as not knowing whether you want to laugh or throw up. It's cold in here, and the air tastes recycled. I pull my coat collar up to my ears. I think that there is no parallel in history where, almost overnight, the offices of a secret service have gone from being so feared they are barely mentionable to being a museum where you can sit in an easy chair next to the boss's private pissoir and watch a video on how his office was stormed. There's a footfall behind me and I start. A small blonde woman in jeans and rubber gloves stands holding a canister of cleaning spray. "Are you closing up now?" I ask. "Should I go?" She smiles and pats the air with a pink plastic hand. "You're all right," she says. "We're the last people left, so we might as well leave together when I'm done." She starts spraying the tables with perfumed ammonia. I turn back to the film. It shows footage of the Stasi mortuary in Leipzig. Bodies on slabs, including that of a young man with no apparent injuries. It switches to an interview with a worker at the Southern General Cemetery who explains that about 20 or 30 times he'd had a call to leave a certain oven open so that the Stasi could do their business. The man looks uncomfortable, but he also shrugs, as if to say, "It was just my job." The voiceover comments that some 30 urns were found at the Leipzig Stasi offices, unlabeled and unclaimed. I wonder whether Miriam knows this. I think I should call her. The next item is an interview with a man with neat hair and a red moustache who was a Stasi psychologist. He is accounting for the willingness of people to inform on their countrymen, which he calls an impulse to make sure your neighbour was doing the right thing. He doesn't bat an eyelid. It comes down to something in the German mentality, he says. A certain drive for order and thoroughness and stuff like that. Stuff like that. There's a cough behind me.
Of course, I lived normally,
the cleaning woman says. I turn around. She has a smoker's lined face and hollow-chested thinness.
I conformed, just like everybody else. But it's not true to say the GDR was a nation of 17 million informers. There were only 2 in 100.
Yes, I say, and then I'm stumped. Even with 1 informer for every 50 people, the Stasi had the whole population covered. She gives up on me.
Can't get these tables clean,
she says, and turns back to her work. When she finishes, we start moving out through Milka's private quarters, his bathroom, and his office. She locks the doors behind us as we go.
You know, there's no real unity in this country, she says. Even after 7 years, I don't feel like I belong here at all. Did you know that in the suburb of Kreuzberg in West Berlin, they wanted the wall back to protect them from us?
She lights a cigarette.
Can you understand this German thinking?
I hope it's a rhetorical question. All I understand is that it only took 40 years to create 2 very different kinds of Germans, and that it will be a while before those differences are gone. We pass a toilet with H for Herren on it.
They only needed a men's bathroom, she says. Women couldn't get past colonel rank, and there were just 3 of them anyway. This was a manor club.
She puts her head into a small room for a sentry.
Have a look at this, she says.
Over the desk, a calendar is still on January 1990.
No, over there.
She points to the other wall behind the desk. There's a smudge on the paintwork.
That's where the fella would have leant back on his chair and rested his fat, greasy head on the wall.
She's disgusted.
Won't come off.
We move on, down the zigzag stairs, past Marx and his billowing hair. The only sound is of our footfalls, and the only light now is from over the entrance downstairs.
Do you get spooked here by yourself at night? I ask.
Sometimes, she says. But it was much worse back when we had just opened. At that time the whole building smelled. We cleaned and cleaned, but we just couldn't get rid of the smell.
She stops walking and turns her face up to me. Even in the half-light, her eyes are cornflower blue and pretty. She winces.
Do you know it?
She does not wait for an answer.
It was the smell, she says, of old men.
Chapter 8. Telephone calls. The phone rings. I steel myself for another Stasi man, but it's a woman's voice.
Anna? Anna, is that you?
Something turns itself over in my chest. It's Miriam.
Yes, Miriam, hello. I've been meaning...
I'm just calling, she says, to say thank you for the other day. I wanted to thank you very much.
What is she thanking me for? Suddenly I know I should have called her earlier.
No, please. I thank you, I say.
Something is odd here. A retreat from intimacy is taking place.
It was very nice to meet you, she says, and I wish you good luck with your work.
This sounds final. I want to ask whether she has heard about the unclaimed urns at the Runde Ecke, but it feels wrong.
Perhaps we could meet again, I say, at some point.
I'd love to, she says quickly.
I'd love you to come down sometime. We could visit my friends who have a sculpture garden. It's very beautiful, and I'd like you to meet them, and... She trails off. Just call me, and we'll go there.
I will, I say, and thanks for everything.
I replace the handset. If I were Miriam and had told the most painful and formative parts of my life to someone, I'm not sure I'd want to see that person again either, especially if my life had already been written down by other people, stolen and steered. The phone is made of black plastic. It's not a walk-around model, but as a compromise, some nifty student attached an extremely long extension cord to it. I walk back through the bare and broken apartment, retracing the lead to its source. I've dragged my mattress into the living room to be closer to the heater. Every evening I watch television until I fall asleep. It is a canny box which receives only 3 channels, but they are of its own choosing, and one of them, although I have no dish, is a satellite channel. They are all black and white, and the terrestrial ones have constant snow. Late at night there's a program called Peep. Guests are interviewed and quizzed about their sex lives in seamy Catch-22 hypotheticals. If your girlfriend brought her sister home to play with you, would you? Is there anything you have had to give up since the reassignment? Footage is shown to tempt the censorship provisions about sex expos, sex experiments, sex reviews, and sexual art. Tonight there's a feature about a Leipzig stripper named Heidi, a.k.a. Yasmina. Yasmina is stocky and firm-bodied with blue eyes and fake blonde hair. This evening she and her brood are doing a horror erotic show inspired by Walpurgisnacht, the night when witches meet to revel with the devil. On the stage, young witches wearing latex masks, leopard skin and lace are undressed by skeletons till they are nothing but rubber faces and sequined G-strings in the dry ice gloom. The camera zooms dizzyingly in and out from breasts and crotches. Then there's an interview with Yasmina, who has pushed her witch's face onto the top of her head so that the nose droops a little over her forehead, nodding when she speaks. The interviewer wants to know what it was like to have had the only strip school back in the GDR, and is it true, he puts the microphone closer to her face, that you stripped for the Politburo? Yasmina smiles and flutters a taloned hand. I always want to offer my public something a little different, she says, then as now. She winks, the nose nods, and the program cuts abruptly to the next segment. Plaster casts of body parts. The first is a female torso, the second a pair of long-nailed fingers either side of a clitoris. An unctuous man's voice says, Peep special! For 250 marks you too can have your most intimate parts preserved forever in plaster of Paris. I'm no longer capable of making sense of this. The whiteness of the plaster reminds me only of the dead Lenin's head on Milka's desk. I switch channels and find my favorite program. It is manna for insomniacs, people like me who do not want to stay still. A camera is attached to the top of a vehicle. As it drives, the pictures glide over the roads and lanes and highways of eastern Germany in glorious summer. The footage is mesmerizing. Flying bodiless through villages, down the main streets, and then out into the countryside again. The shops are open or closed. Aproned women sweep footpaths where people sit drinking coffee. Mothers run from under the umbrellas after straying children. Road workers lean around in overalls. This is the world unfrozen. It's black and white and snowing on my screen, but I know that it is really the bright yellow of rape, the green haziness of wheat, and the heavier green of summer oaks lining the road. Occasionally we stop at traffic lights, level with the hooded eye. Then on and on, moving magically through village after thawed village, places I have never been and may never go. In my sleep, I continue soundlessly through the countryside, exhilarated by the wind on my skin. Suddenly I am joined by another woman flying at the same height. There is a blur where her face should be, but that doesn't bother me at all. She is naked, apart from pink rubber gloves. Her nipples are puckered a deeper pink, and her pubic hair is luscious gold. I'm startled that I'm not alone in the air, that she's naked. "The gloves, of course, are for driving," she says. I nod, and I look at my hands. I have no gloves. Then I look at my body and see that I am naked, too. My feeling of well-being evaporates. I glance down over the main street of a village. There are people beneath us. The church bell starts to ring. It rings and rings and will not stop, and soon I know I'll drop. I have no driving gloves, and they'll all see me fallen and naked and pointless. I wake up to get the phone. The clock says 2:30 a.m., heart attack hour, the hour of bad news from home, or another Stasi man. Telephone harassment is common, but I can't be high on their list. It must be the 15th ring by the time I find the black phone, the duvet wrapped around me. Hello?
Hello, my friend.
A lubricated voice from my local pub, coming down the line through a mouth with a pipe in it, a thick Saxon accent and a beard. It's Klaus. By the sound of it, he's holding his chin up with the receiver.
How'd you pull up after last time?
He asks.
Feel like another drinking session?
Klaus, it's 2:30 in the morning.
Come on, he says. This time the other night you were just getting into it.
I have no wish to be reminded of other nights. In my view, one of the conventions among decent drinking partners is that where there isn't actual amnesia, it should be simulated. The other night we filled the air with words and smoke that are all gone now. My only memory is of the hangover I took with me to Leipzig.
I had a big day.
It's nice here, he says. They're playing our song.
This is not a come-on. He means they're playing his song. Klaus Renft is the legendary Mick Jagger of the Eastern Bloc. He lives around the corner from me in a one-room apartment lined with videos and posters of his band, the Klaus Renft Combo. There are always sports bags full of beer and every kind of smoking equipment known to man. We are both regulars at the local pub, which we use effectively as a living room. The pub sound system is pumping out the plaintive and beautiful song Hilfloss, re-recorded on their recent comeback album.
You still there?
He says.
Yep, and I'm staying here.
Sweet dreams then, kiddo, he slurs.
When he hangs up, the receiver misses its cradle and dangles upside down in the air. I take the phone back to bed. I lie listening to Hilfloss, and then I hang up. I wake to the phone ringing. It's morning.
Guten Tag. You put an advertisement in the Markische Allgemeine.
Yes, thank you for calling. I am looking to speak with people who worked for the ministry in order to be able to represent what it was like. I'm writing about life in the GDR.
There is a pause.
The notice said you were Australian.
Yes.
You are Australian?
Yes.
You are from Australia?
That's right.
In the GDR, a great swathe of geography remained theoretical because people couldn't travel outside the Eastern Bloc. If Easterners thought about Australia at all, it was as an imaginary place to go in the event of a nuclear catastrophe.
You are writing in English or in German?
In English.
I will meet with you, he says. In order to set the record straight, it is possible that in Australia your media has not tainted people against us, and that there, at least, we can put our side, with objective information and analysis. Are you available tomorrow?
Yes.
In Potsdam, in the afternoon?
Yes.
Then I will meet with you as follows. I will be outside the church on Market Square at 1500 hours. I will have tomorrow's Markische Allgemeine rolled up under my left arm. Understood?
Yes, I say obediently, although I am incredulous that this man wants to play spy games 7 years after the fall of the wall. And then I ask, what is your name? Another pause.
Vins.
Till tomorrow, then, Herr Vins. I'm early to the church and stand alone in its forecourt. The sky is blanket grey and close. I'm wearing all-purpose black boots and a black coat with fake fur trim, and I stand out a mile. I have so obviously nothing to do but wait for an assignation. At the market next to the church, women in bright scarves and woolen gloves push their strollers around caravan stalls, nosing under the red and white striped awnings. They buy potatoes and pickles from vats and chunks of pink liverwurst. At the deli, a man with ham hock forearms serves a council worker a sausage and a piece of bread on a paper plate. The bells chime 3 times. I hop from one cold leg to the other. After 10 minutes, a man approaches with a newspaper rolled under his left arm. He's about 60, paunchy, and jowly as a hound dog. He's wearing a foreign-looking tweed suit coat. When he takes the newspaper from under his arm to greet me, I see it even has leather elbow patches. He is disguised as a Westerner.
The parking here is terrible,
Herr Vinn says by way of apology for being late, but also as if it were my fault. He speaks in authoritative barks.
I suggest we go to a neutral place, he says. I usually use the Hotel Merkur.
Neutral? Usually? Fine by me, Herr Vinn's, I say, and we set off on foot to the hotel, a good 15 minutes from here. It occurs to me that he has hidden his car somewhere so that, should I succumb to the urge, I can't tail him. I'm glad to get moving anyway. The hotel has a low-ceilinged lobby with brown booth seats and a lot of plastic plants. There is no one else here. We order coffee from a waiter with a strawberry mark over one side of his nose, and I start to explain to Herr Vins my interest in speaking with former Stasi employees. He waves me silent. He waits until the waiter is well out of earshot. Then he leans forward.
One cannot be too careful these days, he says,
tapping his nose and glancing towards the waiter's back. Then he eyeballs me.
First, please show me your ID, he says.
Bitte?
I would like to see your identity card,
he says. I don't have one.
What do you mean?
He asks. In Australia, we don't have ID cards. He is speechless. He looks at me as though all his suspicions are confirmed. I come from a place so remote, so primitive, that the people there have not yet been labelled and numbered. I give in. But I have a passport, I say, and pull it out of my bag. There are a great many things one cannot do anonymously here, from buying a mobile phone card to travelling on a train. I have had to prove my identity so frequently that I now carry my passport around with me like a fugitive. He reads my date of birth and checks me against my younger self. Then he flicks through its pages to see where I've been in the last few years.
Ah, Czechoslovakia,
he mutters at one point. Then he sees that back in 1987 I was in the GDR.
So you visited my country,
he says approvingly. Yes, I came here to Potsdam, and I went to Dresden, I say. And I went to a party once with some friends in East Berlin. I remember a cold grey day in Potsdam like this one, the streets deserted. Our busload of undergraduates visited only the paved and gilded parts of this showtown, selected streets made into a neat sheep run for tourists. In Dresden, we were shunted up a hill in a cable car and fed a meal which, including the steak substitute, came entirely from tins. At my East Berlin party, the host, a Jewish journalist of impeccable communist pedigree, was revealed after the wall fell to have been an informer. I may gain credibility in this man's eyes from having a couple of hammer and compass stamps in my passport, but it could not be said that I knew his country. I visited it only long enough to wonder what was being kept from me. I ask to see Herr Vinz's ID too, but he fobs me off with a laugh and a dismissive gesture. Behind him the waiter starts, as if this could be a summons, but I catch his eye and shake my head slightly. He slides his notepad back into his apron pocket. Herr Vinz opens his briefcase and takes out papers and pamphlets and a thesis bound in a springboard cover. Then he places a small, hardback book on top of the pile. It is Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, The Communist Manifesto. He tells me he worked from 1961 to 1990 at the ministry in Potsdam, exclusively in counter-espionage. He picks up the thesis and reads its title.
The Work of the Ministry for State Security on the Defense Against Intelligence Infiltration by the Secret Services of the NATO States Against the GDR. Presented from the viewpoint of a member of the Division for Counter-Espionage, Regional Administration, Potsdam. This is a discussion paper I wrote based on my work at the ministry. If you read this, you will learn a lot of what you want to know.
I flick to the front page and see that the paper was written in 1994 for the Potsdam Working Group of the Insider Committee for the Re-examination of the History of the Ministry for State Security, Incorporated. This was written for the Insider Committee, I ask.
Yes.
You are a member?
Yes, but we have changed our name to the Society for the Protection of Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man.
The Insider Committee. Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man? I have heard of this group. It is a more or less secret society of former Stasi men who write papers putting their side of history, lobby for entitlements for former Stasi officers, and support one another if facing trial. They have close links to the successor party to the SED, the Party of Democratic Socialism, and it is alleged that together they may have access to the tens of millions of marks which belong to the SED and remain unaccounted for. It is widely suspected, however, that these men also harass people who they fear may uncover them. A former border guard who appeared on a television talk show was threatened with an acid attack and had to be placed under police protection. Home-delivered harassment is popular. One man had a ticking package delivered to his doorstep. Wives have had to sign for porn not ordered by their husbands. The strangest incident I heard of was when a man was delivered a truckload of puppies, yelping outside his door and the driver demanding a signature. Car brake leads have been cut. Accidents and deaths reverse-engineered. The child of an outspoken writer was picked up from school by a person or persons unknown and taken to drink hot chocolate just for an hour or so. Detaining people clearly has its own pleasures, a habit hard to break. I look at Herr Vinz, and suddenly the landscape here seems crowded with victims, of the Nazis, of Stalin, of the SED and the Stasi, and now this lot, wannabe victims of democracy and the rule of law. What does the Insider Committee do, I ask?
We try to present an objective view of history, he says, to combat the lies and misrepresentation in the Western media.
It is said that the Insider Committee is also a front to coordinate action against those working to uncover what the Stasi did to people.
I wouldn't know about that.
Why not?
I am a small fish, he says. I am here to tell you about the excellent work, the masterful work, of the Stasi in counter-espionage. That is where I spent my life.
Either Herr Vinz doesn't know much, or he's not telling. He won't respond to my questions about the Insider Committee, or talk about himself either. Each time I ask him about the reality of life in the GDR, he returns to the beauties of socialist theory. I think he hopes, through me, to sow the seeds of socialism in an untainted corner of the world.
We had people everywhere, he says.
His main interest seems to have been placing young committed East Germans into lives in West Germany, where they would eventually come into the sights of the West German Security Service and be recruited.
We had them very high up, We had Gunther Guillaume as Chancellor Brandt's secretary, and Klaus Curon in West German counterintelligence, and the woman who prepared Chancellor Kohl's daily intelligence briefings.
This is true, but it is widely known. I find it hard to believe that Herr Vinz was personally involved at a high level. He's too underconfident and unconvincing with all his spy play-acting to have ever done it for real. I try to imagine what he probably did do, because he won't tell me. The best I can come up with is that he wrote procedural manuals. But Herr Vinz is warming to his tale.
The CIA, now, they were bandits, a very nasty crew. Did you know they made 20 attempts on Fidel Castro's life?
They couldn't have been very good then, I smile. He looks startled. He is not amused.
Bandits, he shouts. I said they were bandits.
I cast a look behind him in the direction of the waiter, shuffling busily at his station. If he had any curiosity about this man's origins, it is now well and truly sated. How are you treated today as a former Stasi man? I ask. I would like to find out why he is disguised as a Westerner.
The foe has made a propaganda war against us, a slander and smear campaign, and therefore I don't often reveal myself to people. But in Potsdam, people come up and say,
he puts on a small, sorry voice,
you were right. Capitalism is even worse than you told us it would be. In the GDR, you could go out alone at night as a woman. You could leave your apartment door open.
You didn't need to, I think. They could see inside anyway.
This capitalism is, above all, exploitation. It is unfair. It's brutal. The rich get richer and the masses get steadily poorer. And capitalism makes war. German imperialism in particular. Each industrialist is a criminal at war with the other. Each business at war with the next.
He takes a sip of coffee and holds his hand up to stop me asking any more questions.
Capitalism plunders the planet, too. This hole in the ozone layer. The exploitation of the forests, pollution. We must get rid of this social system. Otherwise the human race will not last the next 50 years.
There is an art, a deeply political art, of taking circumstances as they arise and attributing them to your side or the opposition in a constant tallying of reality towards ends of which it is innocent. And it becomes clear as he speaks that socialism, as an article of faith, can continue to exist in minds and hearts regardless of the miseries of history. This man is disguised as a Westerner, the better to fit unnoticed into the world he finds himself in, but the more he talks, the clearer it becomes that he is undercover, waiting for the second coming of socialism. He pulls himself together and lowers his voice, leaning towards me in a conspiratorial way. His breath is hot and bitter from coffee, and small flecks of brownish spittle spray over the cardboard thesis cover.
Have this.
He passes me the Communist Manifesto from the top of his pile. It looks well loved.
You should read it, he hisses. Then you will understand a great deal more. There is, even today, no better analysis of capitalism. It's a present from me.
He takes out a pen and inscribes it to me,
as a memento of our Potsdam discussion.
Thank you very much. Herr Vinz collects his material and stands up to go. Then he puts one set of knuckles down on the table and pushes his face close to mine.
You can take it from me, he says. I have lived through a revolution already in 1989. And I know the signs.
His voice is getting louder. I can see the veins in his forehead.
This system is on its last legs. Its days are numbered. Capitalism will not last. The revolution,
he raises his fist off the table,
is coming.
Then he marches through the lobby out the front door, and the waiter brings me the bill. A cheery voice.
No one can come to the phone right now, but if you leave a message, someone will call back as soon as possible. If it's good news, even sooner. Bye.
Miriam, it's Anna. I start. Then I hear the electronic beep. I start again. Miriam, it's Anna calling. Just to say hello, really. No news. I'll call back another time, or you can reach me on the Berlin number. Hope all's well. I can't think of any other small thing to say. Bye. For a few days afterwards, each time the phone rings, I think it might be her, but it's mostly Stasi men. After a week or so, despite the Stasi men, I somehow remain hopeful when the phone rings. Another week passes, and this feeling coagulates into something grimmer. Have I offended her? I fill her silence with possible scenarios. She's lost my number. She's on holiday. And even the full-blown, now that she has relived her story, it's all too much, and she's swinging from a rope in her tower. Despite the vividness of this last, I decide to give it another fortnight or so before I call again. At some level, at least, I'm aware that I'm following a person who has been hounded enough. Does telling your story mean you are free of it, or that you go fettered into your future? Chapter 9. Julia has no story. After work, I catch the underground to Rosenthalerplatz, and then walk home through the park. Away from the corner, the grass slopes into a hill, rare for this swamp city. At the top, there is a community centre with a terrace cafe that serves coffee and beer. Saturday afternoons, the centre fills with dancing pensioners moving in tender, timeless coupledom. The pensioners are just visiting. The park belongs to the drunks and the punks. The drunks dress either in tracksuits or old business suits. Each morning they emerge from the corners of the park and shuffle together in an amphitheatre arrangement around the statue of Heine. All day long they hold what look like philosophical discussions, gesticulating slowly with their free hands and clasping tins of beer with the other. They seem to share knowledge of a world where each of them once had a place. Closer to the station are the young people. Here there are women as well as men. They have as much beer and as many cigarettes as the drunks, but a lot more rancor. Their heads are partially shaved or covered with dreadlocks in blue and deep black, their faces pierced, limbs tattooed. Their appearance says both, "Look at me," and "Fuck off." There are fights and tears, terrible pain, public in the park. Sometimes they ask for money. Unlike the drunks who claim the benches and tram shelters, the young people sit or sleep on the ground, with only their dogs for warmth. The dogs often look better groomed than the humans, but this afternoon, passing one young man, I realize I probably underestimate the effort required to maintain a coxcomb of 8 12-inch cones of hair, erect and green, every day. My door is unlocked. Pushing it open, I can see through to the living room. It looks like a giant cat has pissed twice on the lino. Then I hear a sound I know instinctively from my childhood. Possums in the roof. Only the roof of this building is 4 stories higher. I turn around and there's a ladder set up against the wall in the hallway to the height of the mezzanine, about 1 meter under the ceiling. "Only me! Only me!" a muffled voice says. A small behind in army pants is backing out. "I came over to water the plants." Julia turns to me. "I thought I'd just get some of this old stuff while I was here." She passes me a bike pump like a relay baton and climbs down with a shoebox under one arm. "Old love letters," she says apologetically. And to my surprise, she turns red. The blush begins at the neck and moves rapidly up to her yellow hair. This used to happen to me until some merciful god put an end to it, so I don't look, but walk straight through to the kitchen. Julia has started to use the plants as a reason to drop by, both as if she is saving me the trouble of watering them, and by way of gentle rebuke. The plants are two skinny, crooked, bald-trunked palm things in pots in the living room, and not only is it true that I forget to water them, I forget their existence altogether. Subconsciously, I have come to think of this apartment as some kind of closed and self-sustaining universe with its own laws of nature. It tolerates my presence, but demands as little interference from me as possible. I just keep to my tracks, bed to bath, window to desk. Julia comes through to the kitchen. Along with the army pants, she is wearing her usual assortment of black. Black boots, black baggy jumpers, and a black scarf twisted like a dish rag around her neck. Right now she is black, red, and yellow, uncharacteristically patriotic in the colours of the German flag. "Coffee?" I ask. "Love some. I ran out 2 days ago." I look at her and I know that under all those layers of black is a wiry body and a sharp, sharp mind. But there is something about Julia that breaks my heart. She has an honesty I have started to think of as East German, a transparent fairness with all things that leaves her so open. But it's not that. She is a hermit crab, all soft-fleshed with friends but ready to whisk back into its shell at the slightest sign of contact. It's not that either. I don't know what it is. "I've been thinking lately about all the drunks and the homeless in the park," I say. "There were no drunks before the wall came down," Julia says. "I mean," she corrects herself, "in the park, no one was homeless as they are now." They might not have been in the park, but there certainly were drunks. Per capita, the East Germans drank more than twice as much as their West German counterparts. Sometimes they had to live in untenable arrangements because of the lack of housing, divorced couples still together, or newlyweds with the in-laws. Whatever the other shortages were, you could always, always buy beer and schnapps. People were drunk on the job, drunk after work, and drunk at home, putting up with one another in a place from which there was no escape. Julia adds, "You should be careful of those bums, you know." "Oh, the drunks at least seem harmless enough." "Well, they're not," she says. "One of them once climbed up that tree outside the living room window and got in here." "Really? What for?" I realize I think of the road outside as some kind of moat between me and the park. "He took a cassette recorder."
"How do you know who it was?"
"The neighbor said she saw him leaving the building," she says. "You shouldn't leave those front windows open."
I find it hard to picture one of the rubber-legged drunks making his way across the road and shimmying up the ash tree into here.
"It's getting worse, I find," she says. "I mean, not only that sort of thing, but just being on the street, you get harassed nearly every day."
She flips a lank piece of hair off her face, and it flips back. Whatever and whoever they are, those drunks are not aggressive. Fueled by beer, they have reached another world where their potency, albeit limitless, is entirely imaginary. They have never done anything more than nod a greeting as I walk by. Perhaps Julia needs to be able to pin down aggressors, to know exactly who and where they could be. But I am willing to admit that I notice staring men on the street.
"I think that sort of thing happens to me more here than at home," I tell her. "Although it might be just that I notice things more here than at home." "That would be because men can tell you're foreign," she says.
"What do you mean?" I have always assumed I inherited enough from my Danish forebears to pass here incognito.
"Well," Julia says, "you don't look German."
"Oh?"
"You're too pale."
I feel the colour draining from me.
"Your skin is too pale. Your eyes are too pale. When a German has blue eyes, for instance, they are really blue, not your kind of pale colour."
I am fading, blending in with the kitchen walls, which were once white but seem to me now an odd, remarkably flesh-like colour. I look at Julia and she reminds me of myself. Straggly fair hair she doesn't care much about, grey-green eyes and slightly crooked teeth that have seen a bit too much nicotine. I wonder whether she started off a true German, much brighter. I don't know what to say, but she's lost in thought anyway.
I think it's because my first boyfriend was such a macho, she's saying. That might be one reason I react so strongly to harassment. I'm still gazing at her, wondering just how it is that we can have such wrong ideas of what we look like, our colour and shape and the space we take up in the world. Actually, Julia is chuckling, he was macho autentico. He was Italian. How on earth did you find an Italian boyfriend? This conversation is getting weirder. Julia could never have travelled in the non-socialist abroad, as the rest of the world was known, and there was no Italian immigration into the GDR. Involuntarily, an Italian boyfriend of my own flashes to mind. An ice cream vendor with a beautiful voice and a truck with bells. Sweet Mr. Whippy. Oh, long story, she mutters. You know, she says, looking into her mug, having lived in both East and West without moving house, I think I can tell you that there's a difference between sexual stalking and stalking neat. She sits framed by the window onto the yard. The late afternoon light comes through her wisps of hair, illuminating them like live things around her head. In the yard, sparrows wheel and duck through the empty chestnut tree. The sky hangs pale and veined over the rooftops. Oh? I ask. Yes. For instance, when we were teenagers, the local lads would come by in summertime. My sisters and I would be on the balcony, sunbaking. They'd hoon up and down on their motorbikes. Sometimes they'd take their shirts off for us. There was nothing scary about it. But there was also a car, for the GDR an expensive car, a Russian Lada, that would sometimes come and crawl slowly along the street in front of our house. We lived in a detached house a bit outside the town, and there were no other houses around. The Lada had two men in it. That was creepy. Yes, I say. I've decided not to ask questions. I'm hoping Julia will not slip back inside her shell. Must have been different, though, if there were four of you. Some safety in numbers. That car, she says deliberately, was there for me. What? Long story. She takes a sip of coffee and is silent for a moment. It had to do with the Italian boyfriend, actually. The laws of love, I assume, like the laws of gravity, apply everywhere. We are back to boyfriends. Things can end so badly, she says. Not wrong there, I say, though I've been generally of the belief that the young heart is rubbery and unlikely to scar. It was funny, really, I guess. I ended it with my Italian boyfriend when we were on holiday in Hungary. That would have been one great holiday. She ignores me. But that wasn't the end of it at all. Never is, really, is it? No, no, she says. I mean something else. I ended up at the police. What? At least, I thought I was at the police. How? Oh, long story, she says again. I'm realizing this is a code for no story. Instead, she asks me about my trip to Leipzig. I tell her I met a woman whose life was shadowed and controlled by the Stasi, and about the row of Stasi men now lined up in my life. I say I'm looking out for other people, too, who lived through communism, the 20th century's experiment on humans. Julia glances away. I don't have any story of the Stasi or anything like that, she says. The clock in this apartment works, and she looks up at it. Thanks for the coffee. I've got to go. Got a class. I am suddenly far away, thinking of old boyfriends, more experiments on humans. I remember the freedom of youth to mount exploratory expeditions into deeply inappropriate territory. The misjudged, the flaky, the devastatingly dim, the latent homosexual, the baby rock star who sang flat. Afterwards, there's something one does to past lovers, a kind of post-mortem of memory manoeuvre that aspirates all the gooey parts, leaving them dried and stable, unable to bite. The taxidermy of lost love. I don't want to be left here alone now, with all those stuffed heads in my attic, shaking in high winds. Old boyfriends seem like safer ground than old Stasi men. I want to stay. Julia puts her shoebox of love letters on her lap and pushes her chair out. I can't stop myself. Please stay, I say. She looks up, and I can see that she's surprised by my neediness. Okay, then, she says. She puts the shoebox back on the floor with a small cardboard thud. Right, I say, and then the gods abandon me and I blush from collarbone to brow, crimson. I get up to heat more water in a saucepan on the stove. Standing, I can see the corner of the yard where the high stone walls meet, closing us in. A sandpit is tucked in there, and next to it a wooden table. Opposite, the crooked stables seem to be inching, almost audibly, towards the ground. We drink more coffee, and she stays. Later on, we make a meal from what there is in the fridge. Smoked halibut and bread and cheese, with fennel tea. Julia and I were born the same year, 1966,